We don't want to repeat the same garbage, but we've got a big garbage problem. Miami, though, has a big brain solution, and dreamers have a more uncertain future. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll take a deep dive into this region's deepening waste management crisis. Will Miami stop recycling? Will Miami-Dade stop burning? Will Broward stop Mount Trashmoreing? We'll also look at the University of Miami's new mission to test Elon Musk's brain chip to help paralyzed persons lead more normal lives. And we'll examine what's next for the undocumented residents known as the Dreamers, now that Florida may reduce their access to college. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. We're going to start the show today with trash talk. No, we're not bringing NBA players into the studio, but we are going to discuss why South Florida government is having such a hard time managing its waste management crisis. The reality is that our region is running out of places to put our garbage, and the headline of a Washington Post story this week was, in fact, What America Can Learn from Miami's Trash Nightmare. The city of Miami keeps deferring a decision on whether to get rid of recycling because there's so much contamination in the mix. Miami-Dade County keeps deferring a decision on whether to give up on a new waste-to-energy incinerator that no one, including President Trump, wants in their backyard here. And Broward County keeps deferring a decision on whether to augment its major landfill, known as Mount Trashmore, amid concerns about the trustworthiness of the company that runs it. And if you somehow don't think this impacts the quality of life in South Florida, think again. We'd like to know what you think. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me here in the studio for all this trash talk is WLRN's government accountability reporter, Joshua Ceballos, and our Broward County reporter, Carlton Gillespie. And also with us is former Miami City Commissioner Ken Russell, who is now a representative for the environmental nonprofit, the Sierra Club. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks for coming in. Mr. Russell, I want to start with you here because in an op-ed last month you co-wrote in the Miami Herald, you made it clear you felt that confronting this crisis is about reducing waste rather than dumping or burning it. In fact, you called Miami-Dade's reliance on its trash incinerator, specifically the one in Doral that burned down 2 years ago, and the continuing practice of burning garbage a, quote, caveman mentality. Why?
Well, Tim, thank you for covering this very exciting topic of garbage. We've been burning garbage for decades and decades, and there's so many better technologies out there, yet there is not yet any ability to sequester the carbon, the CO2 that's created from burning garbage. So
Which contributes to global warming, et cetera. We've got to move away from it.
And yes, reducing is important because Miami-Dade produces twice the trash of anywhere else in the country.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But knowing that that's a difficult thing to achieve, we've got to look at diverting. What can we recycle and compost away from the stream so that what ends up in our landfills is cleaner and not organic?
Right. Okay. And I do want to get to those. But the incinerator took care of half of that Miami-Dade County trash each year, which mattered a lot because Miami-Dade produces, as you just pointed out, twice the trash that the average U.S. county produces, about 2 million tons a year, largely because we also have so much tourist trash. So if not the incinerator, the options are more landfill, which will now have to be outside the county because we no longer have enough space inside the county, or what you and the environmentalist community call, quote, zero waste. So, Mr. Russell, before we get into that zero waste discussion, first explain briefly why you feel we need to move away from the landfill option as well as the incinerator option.
Well, I look at what's called landfill 2.0. And most policymakers demonize rightfully the old way of landfilling because unlike the CO2 produced by the incinerator, when you put garbage underground and sort of encase it, it breaks down anaerobically without the oxygen, and that creates the methane, which is actually even worse than the CO2.
Than the incinerator.
So rightfully, nobody wants to go back to that. We smell those as we drive up the highway. But there's a new version of landfilling, which is smaller and cleaner and less organic. And that's way better than burning garbage.
Okay. Now, so Joshua Ceballos, again, before we get to the zero waste discussion, let's remind listeners that Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava now seems to agree with folks like Mr. Russell, and she looks set to drop the plan for a new $1.5 billion incinerator, which no one in the county seems to want in their backyard. But she's proposing pushing more of our garbage to a new out-of-county landfill somewhere in Florida, which would cost less to build than the incinerator, but cost more each year to operate and maintain. What's been the reaction to her pivot on this?
Yeah, so the reaction has not been good, at least from the fellow members of the Board of County Commissioners. At a meeting this week, they kind of criticized her for flip-flopping because just a couple of months ago, she said that a new incinerator would be the best option and that landfilling would be bad for the environment. Now she's said, we're going to continue to do landfilling and the incinerator is not a good idea. Mm-hmm. So she faced a lot of flack from the Board of County Commissioners for turning on this issue, but you have to realize there's a lot of extra pressures. She's saying one of the major costs that they could get from doing a new local incinerator is legal costs, people suing, and perhaps even the Trump family suing because of their property in Doral.
Right, exactly. Okay, so here we are. We've looked at what's the problem with the incinerator option, what's the problem with the landfill option. So now then, Mr. Russell, walk our listeners through what the concept of, quote, zero waste entails. Things like construction material recycling, a halt to single-use plastics, which to its credit, right, Miami-Dade County late last year voted to enforce at county-owned properties at least, right? And finally, composting, which I know is a big issue for you. A lot of this might sound a little utopian to folks, so explain to us why you feel it isn't.
Well, it's odd that we feel it's utopian because so many communities have embraced composting, for example, mm-hmm. and we just think we can't do it. Our culture won't allow it. Our habits won't allow it. But there is a very healthy way to do it, which is embraced by many communities around the country and the world, it's the most important element, maybe even more than the plastics, about getting organics out of our stream from breaking down, because that's what's creating the greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. And so separating those streams is actually not that hard.
But how do we separate the streams, though? I was intrigued by this in your op-ed. Is it a matter of like asking people to separate their garbage the way they were doing with recycling, for example? I'm separating this organic stuff from the inorganic stuff. How would that work practically in everybody's kitchen every week?
Yes, at a residential level, it means a third bin. And that bin would be for your scraps, which were going into your regular trash. So it's not producing more or a smellier situation. It's just moving it to a different bin. But the biggest stream comes from restaurant food scraps. Uh-huh. The right type of ordinances can both mandate and incentivize the right behavior of the professional community. And then the municipalities themselves, they're one of the largest collectors of green waste through their every week they pick up the branches and yard cuttings, mm-hmm. and separating that from the landfill can do wonders for compost.
Now, you also mentioned, I think, was also very important, given how important construction is to the economy here in South Florida. You mentioned that we need to be smarter about how we recycle construction materials. Walk us through a little bit of that, if you would.
Another foreign concept to South Florida developers is that we should recycle our demolition waste. All the towers and buildings that come down when we build new stuff just goes to the landfill or to the lakes on the west side of the county. This is the worst thing you can do. Where in other cities, so there are some mandates and even recycling facilities held municipally that break down that concrete into new gravel for roads and asphalt, break down that steel for new rebar, and it can actually go back into the construction of those very sites.
Interesting. Okay, so Josh Ceballos, you just heard the former commissioner's arguments for how we fix our garbage nightmare here, as the Washington Post calls it. One of the zero waste solutions we just discussed here is ramped up recycling, and yet the city of Miami now is one vote away from eliminating trash recycling because it says it's just not working. Specifically, that the trash folks put in their bins for recycling is so contaminated with unrecyclable stuff that it's just not worth doing anymore. Tell us about where things stand with Miami and recycling now and how the city arrived at this point.
Yeah, so there's a lot of factors that go into that. I want to talk about the contamination because that's an issue countywide that we have where people are just throwing things that can't be recycled into their recycling bin kind of indiscriminately. That includes food waste, like Ken was saying, organics. It also means plastic bags. People assume that anything plastic is recyclable. That's not true.
Of course, the industry doesn't help us with this. I mean, every time I want to throw away, you know, plastic into the recycling bin, I'm looking at that little triangle and 80% of the time, it's not one or two, it's three, four, or five, which I can't, you know.
People don't get it. People don't get it. They don't understand what is and isn't recyclable. Yeah. And I think that there needs to be more education on that. So when the recyclable stuff is contaminated by that, it can't be recycled anymore. Yeah. So we're only getting a small fraction of what can be recycled actually going back into the system. Another issue is that the city of Miami has not raised its solid waste fee in many, many years.
Uh-huh.
So
Miami-Dade County did last year, right?
Right. Yeah. So in the city of Miami, they're dealing with more and more population, more and more trash, but not any more funding for the trash pickup and for solid waste.
Okay.
So those factors are coming together where now they're struggling to actually do recycling.
Right. And that's all understandable. But Josh, if Miami-Dade's largest city, meaning Miami, halts recycling, what sort of monkey wrench does that throw into our efforts to reduce the waste that we have to burn or throw into landfills? I guess my real question is, if Miami is going to cancel recycling, what then? What are they proposing to do instead?
Well, as part of the statements from the city, they said that recycling will still happen. You can just take it to a facility. They just won't be picking up recycling. But, you know, if people aren't already, you know, recycling properly at home, I don't think they're going to be going to a recycling facility necessarily. This still needs to go through a couple votes. It's been deferred many times. It was deferred to the next meeting in February.
Yeah.
So they haven't voted on this yet. But you're right, Tim. This could affect Miami-Dade County's plan because it is the biggest city. It has a large tourist population coming in. And if Miami is not recycling, then it's going to be much harder for the countywide to get to this recycling and zero waste goal.
We have Ian on the line from Coral Gables. Ian, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What are your thoughts on this conundrum?
Hey, so two things. One, just on the recycling contamination. The amount of times I've had pizza, you know, I order in pizza, and at the end of the night, you know, I cut up the box in front of my friends, and they're like, you know, why are you doing that? Just throw the whole thing in the recycling. The amount of people who don't know that you can't throw a greasy pizza box in the recycling bin is like, it's crazy.
Yeah, my wife slaps me upside the head every time I try to do that. Yeah, I know what you're saying.
No, good for you. You're better than most. I'm really fixated on. I'm glad the Washington Post article mentioned the trash trains because, you know, I don't really think it's a viable solution. But I think that we're by delaying this conversation so much, we're getting closer and closer to this impending. I don't want to call it a cliff, but like, you know, we're going to end up having to ship so much, you know, garbage up north on trains, and it's just so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as much as I would love to see zero waste happen, I just see us falling, you know, cratering towards this, you know, the same place where L.A. and New York are, where they pay so much money per ton to ship their stuff elsewhere.
Yeah.
Because they can't, they delay their conversation so much.
Okay. Well, Ian, thanks very much for your call. We really appreciate it. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with WLRN's Joshua Ceballos and Carlton Gillespie and former Miami City Commissioner Ken Russell about our region's indecision regarding its garbage crisis. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Carlton Gillespie, I want to turn to you now and look at the Broward garbage crisis, which is all about whether to enlarge the Monarch Hill landfill site, which locals affectionately call Mount Trashmore. But a vote on that question keeps getting kicked down the road, and at the center of all the controversy is a company called Waste Management, right? Walk us through this very baroque situation up there.
We can do the abbreviated history for everybody. Essentially, what matters is that Broward used to have an interlocal agreement with all of its cities and the county called the Resource Recovery Board. This board got to decide where the trash went. It would send it first to a recycling plant. Whatever couldn't be recycled would go to a waste-to-energy plant. And whatever couldn't be burned...
Their own incinerator, yeah.
They used to have two.
Two, okay.
Then whatever couldn't be burned would go to the landfill.
Right.
That dissolved in 2013, largely due to a lack of trust between the cities and the counties. And a new company had stood up called Sun Bergeron that was offering a recycling alternative to Waste Management, who has had a monopoly over the county for a very long time.
And as I said, who runs this landfill known as Mount Trashmore.
Yes, and they used to have an incinerator on this Mount Trashmore site on Monarch Hill. So when Sun Recycling Systems came in, 17 municipalities signed up with them. In response, Waste Management, due to the lack of business, tore down its incinerator, which hamstrung the county's ability to recycle in general, and then bought the parent company of Sun Recycling, which was part of the partnership with Sun Bergeron.
Okay.
They then increased the fees, and Waste Management won all those contracts back the next time they came up.
Right.
So after that, when the Resource Recovery Board was functioning, Broward County was recycling more than 60% of its waste, and now it's about half of that, which means more goes into the Monarch Hill landfill. So now Waste Management has come to the county and said, we need to increase the height of the landfill by 100 feet, up to 325 feet, which critics will tell you is 20 feet taller than the Statue of Liberty, and expand its horizontal base by about 25 acres, and that's the site that the incinerator used to sit on.
And this proposal is not particularly popular with locals then, right?
No. The cities of Coconut Creek and Deerfield Beach, who abut the landfill, are vehemently opposed to this, partially because they've seen Waste Management break its promises before. There was a meeting 10 years ago where a Waste Management representative said, this is the last time in 2015 we're going to ask you to raise the landfill. And there's an audio tape of this, who apparently told the vice mayor of the county, well, you can't go by what we say. You have to go by what's on the paper. And the paper didn't say that we would say this is the last time. So.
Right. So, Carlton, where does it look like Broward County will ultimately come down on all this? What will its solution to South Florida's garbage nightmare look like, do you
think? They will raise the landfill, but that's not the solution. The solution lies in the Solid Waste Authority, which is another interlocal agreement.
And they've got their own plan, right?
Has been delayed for a little bit. They've been waiting for this. They've now given them 27 days until the next commission meeting. They have to come up with this because Waste Management has offered some really powerful concessions to get this deal to happen. Mm-hmm. That includes, like the former commissioner was saying, stripping the organics out of the landfill and sending it up to Kissimmee, paying a larger host fee, limiting out-of-county waste, paying $1 million over the next 10 years on recycling education, and some things that the county sees as crucial moving forward to the waste plan. But when you talk to folks in the Solid Waste Authority, they've also mentioned this solution. It's what they call source separation recycling. And the way that Broward County is going to do that is by getting in the things that residents touch on a daily basis, whether it's Florida Panthers games, the hospital system, the school board, and implementing those multiple bins and those habits there so that people pick them up. Okay. Instead of telling you, hey, you have to do this at your home, we have you do it at, when you go to the hospital
system. Kind of like what we see at airports, for example, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And FLL is another big part of that. Yeah. And then we eventually...
And MIA as well, yeah.
We eventually trickle that down into the residents. So they kind of go top down from these things that people interact with down to increase this source separation recycling.
Well, at least we're seeing some creativity there. That's fascinating, Carlton. Thanks. Finally then, Ken Russell, I just want to ask you in the larger picture, how did South Florida allow itself to get into this trash bind in the first place? What does this say about our culture here and how we tend to brush this kind of problem off until it's too late?
This is about political will and taking the path of least resistance and brushing things under the rug or kicking the aluminum can.
Yeah.
I wanted to see what other communities do that we don't, and how are they getting it right. So I traveled to Austin last week, where Greater Austin's very similar to Miami-Dade. They have over 30% Hispanic population. They're over 3 million residents. They have about the same waste stream. They don't have an incinerator. They have a zero waste philosophy. They're 40% diversion right now from their landfills that they're currently, and they're on their way to 90%. And I talked to their elected officials. They would never dream of installing a waste incinerator in their community.
Yeah.
And so I visited all their facilities. It's all about good vendors, good policy that incentivizes and mandates the right behavior from both your residents, your businesses, and of course your electeds. And then they also set their rates to flow with the actual cost. So it's not a political decision every couple of years. They just do an audit. And if the garbage costs more, they have to pay a little more. But it incentivizes them to keep their costs down.
No, thanks for that perspective from Texas then. Josh Ceballos, same question to you, since this feels like another facet of what we hear often call the Miami mess. Like so many other problems here, is garbage one we waited too long to confront? And if so, what are the lessons moving forward from your perspective?
A lot of government issues in Miami and Miami-Dade County get pushed. And like Ken said, the aluminum can gets kicked down the road. I think the lesson is we need to take action quickly. Our elected officials need to take action so that we can then move forward. Because like you said, we've waited too long and now we're in a crisis situation and we can't continue to be in crises.
Right. Joshua Ceballos is WLRN's government accountability reporter. Carlton Gillespie is our Broward County reporter. Former Miami Commissioner Ken Russell is a representative for the Sierra Club. Gentlemen, many thanks.
Thanks, Dan.
Still to come, Elon Musk's pioneering brain chip comes to Miami. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN.
Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. These days, Elon Musk is known more for political controversy than scientific accomplishment, but this week we were reminded that the richest man in the world's enterprises do produce pioneering technologies. The University of Miami's Miller School of Medicine was chosen as the second research site in the U.S. to test a brain chip developed by Musk's startup Neuralink that promises to let paralyzed persons use all the tech that's necessary for life in the 21st century. The chip, aptly called telepathy, is surgically implanted in the part of the brain that controls thought and directs that thought to operate devices like laptops and smartphones. University of Miami researchers will now conduct clinical trials with the participation of volunteers in their 20s up to their 70s to test whether the brain chip can perform as Musk advertises. And it's happening in a UM facility to cure paralysis established in part by one of the Miami Dolphins' most famous families. What would you like to know or share about this impressive medical tech now being tested here? Call us at 800-743-WLRM, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Michelle Marchant. She's the health reporter for our news partner, the Miami Herald, and she's been following the brain chip's journey to Miami. Michelle, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
I just want to start off by asking you, why was the University of Miami, in particular, the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis at the Miller School of Medicine, chosen to be the second testing site for this pioneering brain chip? And where is the first site, for that matter?
Well, the University of Miami Medical School and the Miami Project, to be specifically, were really chosen because of their reputation and their history of research into devices that actually interact with the body's nervous system to treat spinal cord injuries, ALS, and other neurological conditions. And also, UM is known for its research. I mean, they're always working on different types of treatments and trying to discover ways to help with Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. In fact, recently the medical school opened a new biorepository center.
Right.
To give people an idea of, you know, the type of research they're doing. That's a global genetic library of blood, tissue, and saliva from all over the world. And they're using that to help studies of Alzheimer's, autism, cancer. So it's really just one of our big research institutions here in South Florida.
Right.
And to answer your other part of the question, the first clinical trial here in the U.S. is actually at the Burrell Neurological Institute in Phoenix.
In Phoenix, right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes. But that, just to give people, I'm sorry to interrupt. It's it's one of the world's renowned hospitals for neurosurgery and neurology.
Right. But the way you've laid this out, it does sound like UM was a logical place then for this sort of clinical testing to come to. Tell us about this Elon Musk startup Neuralink and this new brain chip technology it's developing. How did this become a Musk venture? It's not about rockets to Mars or electric cars, after all. And how did it get focused on this particular medical tech it's calling telepathy?
Yeah, so it's not a car or anything like that,
yeah.
Flash, but it is a very futuristic concept of being able to control things with your minds. Mm-hmm. And so he co-founded this company in 2016. And while the focus right now is to treat diseases, he's indicated in previous interviews and just things that he's posted online that his thought of the future is a future where you can merge human and AI, essentially creating, I guess I would say, like a superhuman, because he's indicated that with how fast technology is accelerating, you know, using brain chip and this type of technology can be the future of humankind to just have
right.
us keep up with the tech.
No, that's fascinating. It's almost as if you're using the same concepts of robotics and transferring them to how humans then can perhaps perform tasks that conditions like paralysis no longer allow you to, right?
Yes. And, you know, it's interesting. One of the participants of this trial that was the first one to get it in Phoenix on the brain chip, he's described it almost like using the force of Star Wars to move his computer mouse.
Wow. So, Michelle, let's then walk us through then how this so-called telepathy brain chip works in patients who are paralyzed. And we're talking here about people who have suffered cervical spine cord injuries or motion debilitating conditions like ALS, right?
And so we're talking basically about a coin-sized chip implanted in the brain, sending signals via ultra-thin threads in order to, as you say in your reporting, Michelle, connect thoughts to digital devices, right?
Right. So it's really science fiction, like hearing it.
It does, yes.
It was fascinating to learn how it works. So essentially, the surgeons will go in and implant the device into the part of the brain, like you said, that handles thoughts and body movement. But then those ultra thin wires that they're referring to as threads, they're being implanted with the surgical robot that the needle is thinner than a human hair.
Right.
And once that's implanted in the brain, all of that entire implant's recording these electrical signals that brain cells are sending to each other. And then they're wirelessly sending that to the software that Neuralink's created that will be typically like on a computer nearby. And that software is decoding these patterns of the signals that are coming out and determining what the person wants to do on like the computer screen based on that signal.
Right.
So that's why there's a training component to this. Once the person recovers, the idea is that they would be trained and have to learn how to think about what they want to do. And almost the way that the participant, the first one that did it, the way he's described it previously has been, you kind of have to think and try to attempt the movement, even though you know you can't move your hand,
yeah.
Try to move your hand. So it detects that signal in your brain.
Okay, so I am a person dealing with paralysis condition. I'm in my wheelchair, for example. As you said, I cannot use my hands to operate something like an iPhone or a laptop keyboard. And so these threads that are implanted with this brain, what you've described what the threads do, but what exactly does the brain chip itself do?
So the brain chip is like, I would say, the transmitter. So the threads, from my understanding, will send the information to the brain chip, and then the brain chip is sending it to the software.
I see. Okay. And then the software is off to the side here, then decoding what those threads are interpreting that thought part of my brain is asking to be done, more or less.
Correct. So it's not necessarily reading your brain. It's just understanding and learning your pattern of your signals and detecting, okay, this signal pattern means this.
What part of the brain is it that we're talking about? I mean, it's described as the part that controls thought, but what is it about what are going on with the brain synapses in that particular geography of the brain that something like an ultra-thin thread can actually pick up and then convey to, as you said, that software that's waiting to be told what to do?
Well, for the real scientific answers, you have to go to the doctors,
sure.
Neurosurgeons. But my understanding is, so our brain constantly has all these different cells that they're just constantly sending signals to each other and sending data. And when you have the right amount of data being sent, that's when movement happens. And with paralysis, the way I understand it is that essentially you have something being blocked at some part in the nervous system.
Right.
So it's not fully going through. So think of it's like the door's open and then they're closing the door.
Right.
And what this device is doing is that it's like going, it's reopening that door to send the signal.
That's
essentially
fascinating. And then the end game in all of this, as we've discussed, is that through all that signaling, the person is able to operate a mechanical device like an iPhone or a MacBook in ways that a person who doesn't suffer paralysis would be able to do. No?
Correct. So just to make sure for listeners, there it's not that their hand is moving, but they're thinking about,
sure, yeah,
moving the chess piece in the online game to the left, and they're thinking about doing that motion, and it's actually being done by the software.
Right. No, that it just fascinating. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with the Miami Herald's Michelle Marchant about Elon Musk's new brain chip for helping paralyzed persons perform more tech tasks, which will now be tested at the University of Miami. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. So, Michelle, let's pivot here to the testing that the University of Miami's Miller School of Medicine has been tapped by Elon Musk's Neuralink startup to conduct. Who are the volunteers they're seeking for these clinical trials, and how are they going to be carried out?
So they're looking right now for people that are between the ages of 22 to 75 that have limited or no ability to use both of their hands due to cervical spinal cord injury or ALS. And they also have to have some other criteria, like they have to be able to speak English and they have to have a stable caregiver to be part of this trial. But there's also different aspects to it. For example, the when you look at the clinical trial, it specifically says they're not looking for people who have that they use smoking tobacco, that they have what they describe as poorly controlled seizures, epilepsy, and diabetes. So there's not everyone will be eligible.
Okay.
But they're looking for these specific people right now. Mm-hmm. And they have on their website of Neuralink a registry that people can go to sign up to see if they're eligible and to show that they're interested in being mm-hmm. part of this trial, which, just to clarify, it's an experimental device. And this trial, what they're doing at UM is they're going to test how effective the device is, but also how safe it is.
Right. Now, who are the U Miami doctors involved in this research, and how confident did they tell you they are that this brain chip is going to be the game changer we hope it will be for helping paralyzed persons perform these modern life tech tasks?
So UM's having a team. It's a team of different specialists like neurosurgeons, neuroscientists, biomedical engineers. At the UM site, the trial is being led by Dr. Jonathan Jagid, and also one of the co-investigators is Dr. Alan Levy, who's the clinical director of the Miami Project and is the one that I spoke to for my article.
Right.
And when I was speaking to Dr. Levy, he really sounded optimistic. And I think that, you know, and it's optimistic of what it could do. We've already seen from the two trial participants from Phoenix that they've released information. The company has released information about how they're doing, and they've been able to use the chip to help move chess pieces, play online games. Wow. One of them has actually started to design things using a design software. So it's really fascinating. And we have to keep in mind, while everyone knows this chip because it's from Musk, it's not the only brain-to-computer interface technology that's being investigated.
Sure.
I mean, researchers have been looking into this for years. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different things that are coming out.
Now, your reporting also pointed out potential problems in the mix here, too. Problems they've identified, for example, with this ultra-thin thread that is so important to this thought-to-device signaling connection we've been talking about. What are some of the snags that still have to be worked through, do you think?
So definitely with the threads, we don't know if this is something that will reoccur again or if this is something that they already figured out. They didn't explain why these threads essentially retracted from the brain in the first participant, but they said that they went in and they were able to fix the algorithm to the point that now Nolan Arbog, which was the first person to get the chip here in the US, is actually being able to use it even better than before.
Right.
But besides that, you know, definitely safety, I think, is the key thing here. You know, is mm-hmm. this safe to have in your body?
Right.
What are the repercussions of that? And this study will take a few years to go in, mm-hmm. but I think maybe not right now, but at some point down the road, we're going to hear more talks about, you know, how accessible is this device going to be if it proves to be effective to people?
Right.
What will they actually be able to afford it? How will they get mm-hmm. it? And then also, I'm sure we're going to have cybersecurity concerns just because it is a wireless device.
Exactly. And finally, Michelle, just with the minute we have left here, I want to ask you about the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis that seems to have been an important factor, obviously, in the University of Miami securing this brain chip testing mission. Remind us of the impact that the late Miami Dolphins star Nick Buonaconte and his family, in particular his son, who suffered a paralysis condition, had on all of this.
Yeah, so it was because of that incident that the Miami Project even came about. So his son Mark was playing in a college football game in 1985 and was injured and left paralyzed from the shoulders down. So his father promised that he was going to help find a way for his son to walk again. And that eventually led to him helping create the Miami Project,
right.
Which, as we know, has been doing research all this time. And now Mark is the president of the Miami Project.
Right. No, that's
it's a full circle moment.
It's a very encouraging Miami story. Michelle Marchand is Miami Herald's health reporter. Michelle, many thanks.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, after this week's Florida legislature vote, what's next for the Dreamers? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Of the more than 10 million undocumented people living and working and contributing in this country, perhaps the best known are the Dreamers. They're the 3 million or so brought to this country as children through no fault of their own, which to most Americans, according to polls, means they deserve favorable immigration treatment. That's why in 2014, Florida gave the Dreamers a hand with their educations by granting them cheaper in-state tuition to attend the state's public colleges and universities. But this week, amid the frenzy among Republicans to sign up with President Trump's sweeping crackdown on undocumented migrants, the GOP-controlled Florida legislature voted to take that tuition benefit away from the Dreamers. This despite the fact that just last month, Trump said Republicans should help the Dreamers. Either way, it was a reminder that Congress still has not acted on several bills to help the Dreamers. What is or should be the future for the Dreamers? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now from San Francisco, where she's attending a conference, is Gabby Pacheco, herself a Dreamer, who is the president and CEO of the nonprofit TheDream.us here in Miami. Gabby, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Remind us how enthusiastic Florida's Republicans were back in 2014 about the legislation to grant Dreamers in-state tuition to public colleges and universities. I mean, we're talking about no less than conservatives like then Governor and now U.S. Senator Rick Scott and then State Representative and now Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez, right?
That's right. I was actually there when the vote happened and later at the rotunda where she was moved to tears. They were all so happy, along with other Dreamers there celebrating the fact that this had passed and that it was going to become law. And we got to remember that this bill had been something that had started by Republicans in 2003 by the then Representative Juan Carlos Zapata from Miami, who put his district number HB 119 to represent the students in his district, right? This is right. How much they wanted to get this done.
Right. So what changed? Why do you think the Florida GOP suddenly decided that the in-state tuition for Dreamers was a bad thing? They argued, for example, that it costs the state too much money now. Republican State Senator Randy Fine even said it's, quote, immoral for the state to give undocumented students the same tuition benefit documented students get. What's going on here, do you think?
It's outright politics. You know, immigrants are always the first to be blamed, the last to be helped, and the easiest to discard. And, you know, we've been seeing terrible rhetoric on immigration and immigrants, and they're just following suit, I think. And, you know, it makes no sense for Lieutenant Governor Nunez, who championed this bill, talked about her faith, to turn her back on it now.
Mm-hmm. But you have made the very apt observation that in their zeal to out-Trump Trump, as you've put it, they seem to have forgotten that President Trump has actually called on Republicans himself to help the Dreamers. Let's, in fact, listen to Trump on NBC's Meet the Press just last month saying that.
What about Dreamers, sir, Dreamers who were brought to this country illegally as children? You said once back in 2017, they, quote, shouldn't be very worried about being deported. Should they be worried now?
The Dreamers are going to come later, and we have to do something about the Dreamers because these are people that have been brought here at a very young age, and many of these are middle-aged people now. They don't even speak the language of their country. And yes, We're going to do something about the Dreamers.
What does that mean? And what are you going to do?
I will work with the Democrats on a plan, and if we can come up with a plan. But the Democrats have made it very, very difficult to do anything. Republicans are very open to the Dreamers. The Dreamers, we're talking many years ago, they were brought into this country. Many years ago. Some of them are no longer young people. And in many cases, they become successful. They have great jobs. In some cases, they have small businesses. Some cases, they might have large businesses. And we're going to have to do something with them. And
you want them to be able to stay. That's what you're saying.
I do. Okay. I want to be able to work something out.
So rather than work something out for the Dreamers, it would seem the Florida legislature has now decided to throw the Dreamers out in defiance of the leader they claim to be doing this for. I guess my question to you then, Gabby, is how does what the legislature did this week set back President Trump's stated wish that we just heard there to help the Dreamers?
Well, here's the thing, right? We know that what happens in the state of Florida, others are looking at. And what these politicians don't know is that we're going to probably see now the state of Texas say, well, if Florida did it, Texas can do it. And it could create a domino effect where we're going to see now not just the 6,500 right now students who are in college no longer being able to afford, but a wave of anti-immigrant thoughts, right, towards Dreamers and this community.
Right. And we should point out that we have about 40,000 or so Dreamers currently attending higher education in Florida, thanks to this law passed in 2014 that allows them in-state tuition, correct?
So it's about 6,500 that have the waiver. There are all kinds of Dreamers, right? Some of them are in high school. And that's the saddest thing for me, Tim, that right now we have over 1,000 people who are applying to the Dream.US scholarship. Our round closes at the end of February. They want to go to the Miami-Dade College, the FIUs, the UCFs, and now are not going to be able to do it, are not going to be able to afford it. So there is a big, large population of young people who are seniors, juniors, sophomores, and are now looking and saying, why does a politician tell me that my dream of going to college is not worthy?
Right. I should have said more accurately, since the legislation passed in 2014, we've seen about 40,000 Dreamers come through higher education because of this benefit. And as you point out, each year we see on average about between 6,000 and 7,000 students who are able to avail themselves of that benefit, correct?
That's right.
Okay. Now, as you've also argued, Gabby, this potentially hurts Florida, especially in an economic sense. Why is that?
Well, here's what they don't tell you, right? They say, oh, you know, it's a burden to our state. They're taking their spots if you're a citizen. And that makes no sense. Our 28 state colleges have open enrollment, and majority of the students that are at the universities have transferred from the community colleges, the state colleges, to the 4 years. And every year they're paying close to and more than $15 million in tuition and fees, because unlike their counterparts that are graduating from high school that are eligible for federal aid, Bright Futures, a lot of them earn it. They get Bright Futures, but because of their immigration status, they're not able to get it. So
right.
These are paying out of pocket $15 million every year for their tuition and fees.
But as you and as we just heard President Trump himself say, the Dreamers who do go through higher education here often end up starting businesses, getting really good paying jobs, and in essence, contributing to the revenue base of this state.
Yeah. A high school diploma will earn somebody, right, about $38,000 a year versus somebody with a bachelor's degree starts earning around $69,000, $70,000. We know from our students, our alumni that have been able to benefit from this, that are working at Apple, that are working at Procter & Gamble, that are working in, you know, Fortune 500s, but also in our schools. We have nurses. We have people who are right now in medical school. So it really is going to shoot ourselves in the foot by doing this, not only to the families and those young people, but our whole entire state.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Gabby Pacheco of the Dream.us about the future of the Dreamers after the Florida legislature's vote to end their in-state tuition benefit this week. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Gabby, I want to look at the larger picture for the Dreamers then, because I think the Florida legislature's vote to repeal their in-state tuition raises the larger question of what the Dreamers' future is now. We've heard earlier President Trump saying it's time for Congress to, quote, work something out in terms of legalizing the Dreamers' immigration status in this country. But we've been waiting for Congress to do that for most of this century, and nothing gets passed. Remind us what Dreamer bills like the Dream Act are sitting in Congress right now.
Well, we know that the Dream Act was first introduced in 2001, and there's been tons of different dozens of variations of it. And here's the thing that people don't really understand is that every single one of those bills has an education requirement to it. So not only are we telling the folks that you cannot go to college anymore, we're going to make it super costly for you to do that, virtually making it impossible. Now, and if the bill passes like a Dream Act, now you're not going to really be eligible because one of the requirements says that you must be in college or be in the process of doing that.
Very good point. Yeah. Do you have hope, though, that in this Congress, given President Trump's stated desire, that something could finally get moving this time?
Yeah, you know, I think that I called him out on this, too. And I said, Mr. President, if you want to do this, let's do it. And, you know, there's Democrats ready to go, Republicans ready to go. There's always been bipartisan. The Dream Act actually passed Congress once upon a time and the Senate, right? It just hasn't moved forward. And so I am hoping that with the pressure that we're going to receive and that people are learning about this, right? And thank you for having your listeners learn more about this. But I'm hoping that we are able to fix this issue once and for all.
Do you worry, though, that the program created by President Obama in 2012, known as Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, which has so far shielded Dreamers from immigration actions like deportation, could that somehow get eliminated itself and make Dreamers vulnerable to President Trump's sweeping crackdown on undocumented migrants now?
Yeah, you know, the reality is that majority of those people are now in their 30s and 40s. So the younger Dreamers don't have DACA today. But that has been going into court. And the Fifth Circuit 2 weeks ago did come out, and we probably will see this moving to the Supreme Court, where the likelihood of the DACA program continuing is probably very low. So all those individuals that have had for 12 years work authorization have been integrated into our community will now be vulnerable, will lose their jobs and be open for deportation.
Right. Gabby, in the minute or so we have left, I also want to ask you about your own experience as a Dreamer. You came here as a child from Ecuador, right? Correct?
That's right. When I was 8 years old.
Now, speaking not so much as the president of the Dream.us, but as a Dreamer yourself confronting these issues, what emotional effect do actions like the Florida legislature's this week have on you?
Well, Tim, I have fought so hard to belong in this country and this nation. I love my country. I love South Florida. It's my home. And I fought so hard to be able to belong. And I proudly became a United States citizen in 2023. I volunteered to say the Pledge of Allegiance in front of the other 60 people doing that. And it's a constant reminder. I remember when I was a young child learning about history and how once upon a time, women were not allowed to get higher education, people of color. And it just reminds me again that we've had to fight for people's rights and that, you know, this country sometimes gets it wrong. They are wrong right now and they're wrong what they're doing for immigrants. But as a American today, I'm going to fight for my country. I'm going to fight for my community. Okay. And I want them to know that this is my country. This is my home.
Gabby Pacheco is president and CEO of the nonprofit TheDream.us in Miami. She spoke with me from San Francisco. Gabby, many thanks.
Thank you.
Finally on the roundup, we all know Sunday, February 2nd, is Groundhog Day. We don't exactly think of South Florida on that day. We, of course, think instead of groundhogs like Punxsutawney Phil in Pennsylvania predicting the arrival of spring. But the fact is, we have our own tropical soothsayer down here in the Keys,
And it's, of course, a conch, our very own mollusk meteorologist, which from a tank at the Florida Keys Aquarium Encounters in Marathon makes its own determination about an early or late end of winter. The so-called ground conch emerges from its shell, looks around, and, like Phil, always gets a reaction from the gathered crowd, like this one 2 years ago.
Here's the dump.
Or as Ben Daughtry of Florida Keys Aquarium Encounters put it then.
Our mollusk meteorologists concurred with Punxsutawney Phil and saw its shadow today and is predicting six more weeks of winter in the north because it's beautiful here in the Florida Keys.
You can watch the ground conch predict spring in Marathon this Sunday from 7 a.m. to 8 a.m. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Today's show is produced by Helen Acevedo. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. Richard Ives answered the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.